Okay, you need to also take the video off of everybody and
But yeah.
video feed.
Okay, let me find that. I can't find that yet. Security.
Still see
Okay,
some.
everybody needs to turn their video off. I'm not smart enough to figure out how to do it right this moment, so.
I think you can go to participants. Let me figure it out. Go to
Yeah,
participants.
I thought it was in the security, but it's not.
I think you can, I mean, you can do them individually in participants, but I don't know. Anyway, hello everyone. Welcome to the 73rd webinar on the Secret Doctrine. This webinar series is available on Makara.us under the subheading Moray Federation Webinars and Webinar Series in Progress, as shown here. All episodes of this webinar series, the Secret Teachings of All Ages, and the Treatise on Cosmic Fire series are also available on YouTube. Just do a search for Francis Donald and the webinar series you'd like to view. You can also access any of these webinars on the homepage of moriafederation.com. It's the easiest way to join up, especially if you don't haven't been sent a link. Just go to moriafederation.com and there they all are. Okay. This month in old diary leaves, Colonel Olcott works with colleagues to design a Buddhist flag that, with a few modifications, is still being used by Buddhists today. So, Olcott continues to surprise in how much influence he still has. Could we get a reader, please?
Yes, I'll start us off. Maybe if I can see. It was at this time that our Colombo colleagues had the happy thought of devising a flag which could be adopted by all Buddhist nations as the universal symbol of their faith, thus serving the same purpose as that of the cross does for all Christians. It was a splendid idea, and I saw in a moment its far-reaching potentialities as an agent in that scheme of Buddhist unity, which I have clung to from the beginning of my connection with Buddhism. With the many points of dissemblance between Northern and Southern Buddhism, the work of unification was formidable in one, yet still in view of the other fundamental features of agreement, the task was not hopeless. My Buddhist catechism was already circulated in Japan in two translations, and now this flag came as a powerful reinforcement. Our Colombo brothers had hit upon the quite original and unique idea of blending in the flag the six colors alleged to have been exhibited in the aura of the Buddha, these sapphire blue, golden yellow, crimson, white scarlet, and a hue composed of the others blended. The adoption of this model avoided all possible causes of dispute among Buddhists, as all, without distinction, accept the same tradition as to the Buddha's personal appearance and that of his aura. Moreover, the flag would have no political meaning whatever, but be strictly religious.
Thank you, BL. You faded in and out for a bit. Just volume. We heard you the whole time, but your volume got weak for a little bit. Just heads up. Okay, and the last page of this.
Yvonne, can you read that for us, please?
Sure. As the Colombo Committee had sketched the flag, it was of the inconvenient shape of a ship's long streaming pennant, which would be quite unsuitable for carrying in possessions or fixing in rooms. My suggestion that it should be made of the usual shape and size of national flags was adopted, And then we had had a sample, when we had had a sample made, it was unanimously approved of, accepted by the chief priest as Orthodox. It at once found favor, and on the Buddha's birthday of that year was hoisted on almost every temple and decent dwelling house in the island. From Ceylon, it was since found its way throughout the Buddhist world. I was much interested to learn some years later from the Tibetan ambassador to the viceroy, whom I met at Darjeeling, that the colors were the same as those in the flag of the Dalai Lama. The importance of the service thus rendered to the Buddhist nations may perhaps be measured with that of giving, say, to the Christians the cross symbol or to the Muslims the crescent. The Buddhist flag, moreover, is one of the prettiest in the world, the stripes being placed vertically in the order above written, and the sequence of the hues making true chromatic harmonies.
Thank you, Yvonne. Okay. Last time, we continued our study of the interim chapter, Additional Facts and Explanations Concerning the Globes and the Monads. Such a catchy title. Where we learned that the evolutionary development of a root race is recapitulated during the following root race, but on a higher turn of the spiral. Next, we learned that the door to the animal kingdom is closed in the middle of the fourth round, so that the human kingdom can transition into the fifth kingdom of nature. The two events are definitely connected, the closing of one door, the opening of another. HPB then reemphasizes the fact that humanity did not and could not evolve out of the animal kingdom. This was followed by a description in the old commentary of the path that the half-man, half-animal anthropoids are taking in order to fully enter the human kingdom. We were then told that the non-intelligent but super spiritual man was in the first round and first race on Globe D, similar to man in the first race of the fourth round. See, you can see the two similar placements here. That's helping us to understand the relative tenuity of humankind between rounds and races. You can see the lineup of the numbers is what interconnects them. We were then told that non-intelligent but super spiritual man was in the, hang on a second. The old commentary then continues with a description of the races as it developed from one round to the next, in terms of tenuity or ethereality, as well as mentality, emphasizing the fact that as humanity developed manas, it lost touch with its innate spirituality. We ended our last session with a passage on the development of languages through the root races. And this takes us to where we left off last time. So let's start by rereading this passage from the old commentary on round four. Can we get a reader, please?
Hira, can you read that for us, please?
Round. Intellect has an enormous development in this round. The hitherto dumb races acquire our present human speech on this globe, on which, from the fourth race, language is perfected and knowledge increases. At this halfway point of the fourth round, as of the fourth root or Atlantean race, humanity passes the axial point of the minor Manvantara cycle, the world teeming with the results of intellectual activity and spiritual decrease. This is from the authentic letter What follows are the letter remarks and additional explanations traced by the same hand in the form of footnotes.
Thank you. Okay, first. Fourth round. Intellect has an enormous development in this realm. The hitherto dumb races acquire our present human speech on this globe, on which, from the fourth race, language is perfected and knowledge increases. So monastic development is being especially stimulated during our current fifth subrace of the fifth or Aryan root race. The importance of number is preeminent here, and the number five is always connected with manas, as we can see with even a cursory glance at this list from TCF, which I won't read, or we won't read, but you can see all of them have to do with mentality, the monastic principle, the ray of concrete knowledge, etc., right? And this characterizes our, not only our race, but our sub-race at this point, this energy. Next, at this halfway point of the fourth round, as of the fourth root, or Atlantean race, humanity passes the axial point of the minor Manvantara cycle, the world teeming with the results of intellectual activity and spiritual decrease. So a major Manvantara is a chain. The minor Manvantara here cited is the fourth round. This is the most material point in the entire Earth scheme. Two factors, dense materiality and the activation of manas, led to the decrease of humanity's natural spiritual state, which is why the Dark Brotherhood chose that time to overwhelm the fourth root race. Okay, next up, could we get a reader, please? By the way, please speak if you have any questions, any thoughts at all about any of the material. As is always the case, it's always more interesting, you know, when we have some dialogue going on. Okay, a reader, please.
Hi, Priya. Can you read for us, please, today?
Yes.
Thank you.
These are the words of the teacher. Text, words, and sentences in brackets, and explanatory footnotes. It stands to reason that there must be an enormous difference in such terms as objectivity and subjectivity, materiality and spirituality, when the same terms are applied to different planes of being and perception. All this must be taken in its relative sense, and therefore there is little to be wondered at if, left to his own speculations, an author, however eager to learn, yet quite inexperienced in these abstruse teachings, has fallen into an error. Neither was the difference between the rounds and the races sufficiently defined in the letters received, nor was there anything of the kind required before, as the ordinary Eastern disciple would have found out the difference in the moment. Moreover, to quote from a letter of the Masters, 188, the teachings were imparted under protest. They were, so to say, smuggled goods. And when I remained face to face with only one correspondent, the other, Mr., had so far tossed all the cards into confusion that little remained to be said without trespassing upon law. Theosophists, whom it may concern, will understand what it meant.
Thank you, Priya. Interesting passage, but to my mind, needs no line-by-line commentary, except perhaps to acknowledge that the term objectivity and subjectivity, materiality and spirituality are always relative and relational terms. For example, the monadic plane, which we tend to think of as the ultimate subjectivity, is literally material and objective in relation to the cosmic plane. Most of this is, it's just her reflections on the old commentary that we were just looking at and, you know, discussing its limitations. So we'll continue. Next up, can we get a reader, please?
Sorry, Martha, can you read that for us, please?
Here I am. The outcome of all this is that nothing had ever been said in the letters to warrant the assurance that the occult doctrine has ever taught or any adept believed in the preposterous modern theory of the descent of man from a common ancestor with the ape, an anthropoid of the actual animal kind, unless metaphorically. To this day, the world is more full of ape-like men than the woods are of men-like apes. The ape is sacred in India because its origin is well known to the initiates, though concealed under a thick veil of allegory. Hanuman is the son of Pavana Vayu, the god of the wind, by Arjuna, a monster called Kesari, though his genealogy varies. The reader who bears this in mind will find in Book 2, Vasim, the whole explanation of this ingenious allegory. The men of the third race who separated were gods by their spirituality and purity, though senseless and as yet destitute of mind as men. These men of the third race, the ancestors of the Atlanteans, were just such ape-like, intellectually senseless giants, as were those beings who, during the third round, represented humanity. Morally irresponsible, it was these third-race men who, through promiscuous connection with animal species lower than themselves, created that missing link, which became, ages later, in the tertiary period only, the remote ancestor of the real ape, as we find it now in the Pithecoid. I think it's Pithecoid family.
Yeah, that's right, Pithecoid. Thanks, Martha.
I lighted over the quotes. I hope that was okay.
It's fine. Okay. Yes, Yvonne.
Where does Bigfoot come in?
Oh, that's good. That's a good question. First of all, we'd have to find him and talk to him to find out, huh? Is he part of this, a survivor of this sort of anthropoid, you know, half human, half animal, therefore having a birthright to the human family, or is it some primate, you know, very large primate that has survived? Who knows? So first of all, just Pasim. I always love these Greek terms that HPB throws in. It just means to be found in various places throughout the text. In this case, she's talking about the second volume of the Secret Doctrine, which is riddled with this information about men of the third root race, etc. First, the occult doctrine has never taught, nor any adept believed in, the preposterous modern theory of the descent of man from a common ancestor with the ape, an anthropoid of the actual animal kingdom. So why is this preposterous? Because evolution invariably moves up through the kingdoms of nature. That's from the mineral to the plant to the animal to animal man as the highest example of the animal kingdom, which was prepared over eons by lunar petries, and finally through the intervention of the Manasaputras to the human kingdom, right? Anthropology, or more specifically, paleoanthropology, hypothesizes the reverse, because, you know, the commonly accepted fact, commonly accepted theory that humanity evolved out of the animal kingdom, because science depends on the fossil record, which doesn't contain the non-skeletal remains of earlier root races. Yes, Ariane.
We see your hand up there.
Yeah. Hello. I'm sorry I got in late, and so I'm also new to this this club. So I may be asking something that's really evident to everyone else, but it's very confusing to me. So I just want to say what I understand rudimentary that it is, and then if you could correct it and add to it just in summary. So sure. The earliest beings that were like humanoid on this planet from, you know, sort of like genetically modified organisms or something, they were brought in here. They didn't have a physical body. They just had an etheric body. And then eventually they were put into, is this before or after they were put into sort of an animal or ape-like body, but it was still etheric, and only when those beings had sex with other physical beings, like, I don't know, physical apes that were along a different rate, lineage, different kind of evolutionary arc, did humans take a physical form? Could you just summarize these ideas and correct me where I'm
wrong? Sure. And I appreciate your question. You know, whenever you ask a question that you think is rudimentary, and you think everybody else is going to know the answer, there's going to be 10 other people at least who don't and can use, you know, can benefit from the answer. So, you know, never feel shy about asking basic questions about anything connected with theosophy, you know, because it's the whole point is that you understand what's going on. So, well, I'll just speak in terms of this round, because otherwise it turns into a long lecture, right? So in this round, actually, I'll even illustrate my answer here. Go back and see where I was. I'm up on 27 now. Go back to 16. So we looked at this slide in the introduction. Okay. So in a chain, which all of this together illustrates, you have seven rounds, through which the globes of a chain represented by A, B, C, D, E, F, G, these seven globes of each, seven globes in a chain are visited seven times. And those seven visitations are rounds, right? So the same seven globes are revisited seven times going all the way around, right? Humanity develops first a fiery body. It's as fiery as the globes on which it lives, and eventually moves into the element of air and then water, in this round earth, and then back up through water, air, and fire again. But these elements aren't equivalent to the elements as we know them on earth. They're only have some quality associations with them, with the elements as we know them, but they're not the literal elements that as they exist on our planet. So the in moving through these rounds and in moving through the globes of any round, there's developed a denser constitution, you could say. And so now I'll just confine myself to this fourth round, since that's what she's talking about here. Even though, as we pointed out, there are equivalencies in terms of the level of ethereality. You know, what he's saying here is that the very first root race, but on globe D, was equivalent to the very first root race on globe A. That shouldn't be a D, that should be an A, on this round. So it just shows the nature of connection. But anyway, in this round, humanity is projected from its lunar fathers, they're called, or lunar petries. They're literally projected shadows from those beings. And rather than any kind of procreation at all, there literally exist, Hinduism calls them chahayas, which are these shadow beings that are projections from their creators, right? So they are like their creators, but only in physical form. There's no mind at all. So that persists through the first and second and the first half of the third root race, where there's a gradual densification. And then in the middle of the at the middle of the third root race, the humanity develops the ability to procreate. It has finally descended into the material realm enough that they can procreate. But unfortunately, they are not at that point immediately overshadowed by the soul, the agency of soul called Manasaputras. As a result of that, they have no intelligence and they procreate with animals. And this creates this aberrant side race, you could say, that HPB calls anthropoids. And as a result of that, there had to be a path created for them to make their way back into the human kingdom, because one of their parents was a human being. So that's a kind of sideline for that. But beginning in the middle of the third root race, the soul aspect overshadowed humanity, and the human beings of that time truly entered the fourth kingdom of nature as we now know them, then progressed in the through the four root races of, I was actually, when I was pointing up here, I was actually talking about this globe that we're now on called the Earth globe or globe D. And we were just talking about the third root race. And so then the fourth root race, the Atlanteans occurred, where humanity was emotionally polarized and only in a little, some basic elemental mentality developed. And now we're in our fifth root race, where the whole point is development of mind, the monastic development. So I hope that answered your question. If not, you're welcome to ask again. Did Greg Moffat have a hand up, or was that just
Gordon, I thought Gordon, I saw his. Oh,
he came in late.
Yes, is my hand up now?
But you can go ahead. You can go ahead, please.
It doesn't matter. Just go ahead if you have a question.
So then man's physical body essentially kind of condensed from the etheric rather than evolving from a physical animal body.
Exactly right. That's correct. It's just the reverse of what science teaches in that way, right? There was a fundamental shift in the way human beings were created in the middle of the third root race, this little number three down here, which is that there was first what was called the sweat-borne, and then the egg-borne, and you know, none of these things are to be taken too literally because they become ridiculous, you know. But because they were still in etheric matter, it was the first stages of procreation, right? But then in the middle of the third root race, they actually created other human beings as we do today, you know, through procreation. And it was at that time that the error was made, and this sideline of anthropoids was created through no sin of the humans and animals involved, because they were devoid of mind. The blame actually goes on that group of Manasaputras who refused to overshadow man at that earlier time. They wanted a more developed rupa or form in order to overshadow, but because they didn't step in and overshadow humankind, then this error was came about. These are not the apes of today, by the way. That is an animal kingdom phenomena. This was something that was created in the in another root race. Ariane, do you have a question?
Yes, sorry to interrupt again, but
no problem.
I'm wondering about when the soul enters humanity in relationship to this event. And then I have a comment about this drawing. So in relationship to this procreative side, this was before the soul entered humanity, right? When the anthropoids were created?
Right. It was in after procreation began in the first half of the third root race, it was at that time, and before they were overshadowed, that the anthropoids were created. Then the great event of 21 million years ago, when the Manasaputras acquiesced, is the name, meaning that they began overshadowing humanity. And it was then that mana, so the mind aspect, truly began to develop. Before that, it was a kind of instinct, animal instinct that had come to the fore.
Yeah, so I just want to remark on just a small item looking at this chart. You know, when you look at the law of octaves, and that there's seven like notes here, and that there's an interval between the third and fourth do, re, mi, fa, where there's no half tone, where an interval occurs, and for things to continue in a directive or upward influence or manner, there needs to be an outward influence, hopefully of upward or superior quality, that interjects a directive. And that's why you see at the beginning of the third round, that it deviated and went downward, and something from outside had to come in to rectify that, according to the law of octaves.
Yeah, well, okay. You brought up some fascinating points. First of all, it's not the third round, it's the fourth round, third root race that we're talking about. It's really, really easy to mix these terms. Yeah, so see where my cursor is? That's where we're talking about, not the third round itself. Okay. But still, your point holds in terms of octaves. In Initiation in Human Solar, DK actually tells us that our planetary logos is sounding the note fa, do, re, mi, fa. And so, you know, there's very much to what you said about the word and the sound that is emanating forth. But in terms of the octave, the first and seventh round, and on a smaller level, the first and seventh planets of each round are on the highest level. And then you have the second and sixth on the next level down, the third and the fifth on the next level down, and only the fourth or the densest planet is on the fourth. So this is all representative of only four levels of tenuity here, not seven, right? In other words, it goes into density and then back out. But nonetheless, there is a sounding forth of a note based on the level of tenuity. And you have a literally a chord created, you know, in relation when you combine the subrace, race, globe, round, and chain. You literally have a chord sounded that demonstrates that point of evolution. Yes, Ariane.
I'm done. But okay, thank you okay. so much.
So, right. You know, everybody just has a habit, as soon as you get called on, just click the down hand button. It makes it easier. So thank you, Ariane, for your comments.
Okay, first off, Fred, I saw you unmute yourself. Did you have something you wanted to say earlier? Fred? Okay, yes, I don't.
Okay.
All right, and then we have a, hold on a minute, it's long. Okay, Helio's soul voice says, what does it mean overshadowing humanity for newbie? It is a strange term. Does it have negative connotation? According to the context, it does not. But the word overshadowing confuses me. Please clarify. Still want to understand the role of Manasaputras, who they are within the evolution, and what did they do wrong? Thank you.
All right. Well, we'll just go right down the line. Since you wrote it out here, I can follow it quite easily. Overshadowing is a term that means that there is a higher form of consciousness that has forged a link to a being of lesser consciousness. And the willingness to do that binds that higher being in terms of responsibility to the lesser being. You know, one of the ways that overshadowing is used is in terms of the Christ, who was a sixth initiate, overshadowing Jesus, who took the fourth initiation on the cross. And so during his life, and since he was chosen as to be an avatar for the Piscean age, the Christ, you could say, acquiesced, you know, agreed to overshadow Jesus during that lifetime. And as a result of that, Jesus was able to tap into the consciousness of the Christ during his lifetime. He would have been his own master on high, right? So does that make sense in terms of the nature of what overshadowing means? Now, when a soul acquiesces to overshadow a human being, it's the same idea that it forges a link and that we follow that link in order to gain soul consciousness by the building of the Antikarana. And that may also be a new term for you, but you know, at some point you have to use the terms that exist. It's not a negative. I know the word shadow sounds negative, but it just means, you know, really more correctly, it'd be overlighting, you know, overlighting, because it's really a higher light source that illuminates the lesser. Let's see, and the role of the Manasaputras. So they agreed to this process, which takes millions of years, that is to influence the animal man until at the third initiation, that human being becomes soul infused. And as a result, is able to literally take on that which the soul had provided up until that time. At that point, the causal body is shattered and the new initiate is acting as the soul. Now, the new soul being the monad. There's, you know, lots more to be said, but that's just a thumbnail sketch about this. Thanks for your question. And I see Ariane has her hand up again.
Okay, yes, sorry, I can't resist. And then I'll be quiet. That when you describe the overshadowing of Christ with Jesus, which some of us know well, that also is a template for everyone here in this room about what it means to be conscious, because there's like a sense that Jesus had an awareness of himself and the Christ moment to moment, and they were sharing his body. And so, I mean, obviously there's the, you know, when you take communion in the church, and that is a symbol of that, but mm-hmm. that taking in of the Christ and being aware of something higher moment to moment is the recipe for higher states of consciousness, because you're aware of self continuously, and then you're aware of something higher continuously. Right. We can't sustain that kind of attention, but that's what I think everyone.
Eventually you can. But yeah, it's periodic at first, you know, it comes in. And in fact, at first it's just peak moments where you have some experience of that. But then later it becomes more sustained. Yeah, and the idea of the Christ overshadowing Jesus is, that's why the soul is called the Christ principle, because it overshadows our personalities in the same way that that Christ overshadowed Jesus, and sustains our very being, even though we may not be conscious of that. It's what makes us a human kingdom. Really, there is no fourth kingdom in nature on its own. It's really a combination of the third and fifth of animal man and the fifth kingdom of souls intersecting that creates the fourth kingdom. Okay, anyone else? Okay, great, good questions. All right, now let me get back to Okay. Right. We went through this, the idea of, next, to this day, the world is, I love this. This is vintage HBB, classic stuff. To this day, the word world is more full of ape-like men than the woods are full of men-like apes. A perfect example of HPB's acerbic humor. What she's saying here, of course, is that the anthropoids that were created at the end of the third root race are not walking around in the woods at this point, but there are a lot of human beings that act like apes. That's all she's saying. Next. Though we briefly touched on Hanuman last time, let's take a look at the Theosophical Glossary's entry on this subject. Could we get a reader, please?
Yes. Ariane, would you like to read that for us, please?
Yes. So it says, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. The deep reverence that the Hindus for ages have held for Hanuman is based on an intuitive, but nevertheless traditional, remembrance of the connection, more intimate than a present, that existed during Atlantean and even Lemurian times between human beings and the apes and even monkeys. The monkeys, although now static stocks, were originally derivative from Lemurian humanity, just as the anthropoids were later derivatives from miscegenations between undeveloped Atlantean savages and the monkeys of those distant times. I better read that again, I'm sorry. The monkeys, although now static stocks, were originally derivatives from Lemurian humanity, just as the anthropoids were later derivatives from miscegenations between undeveloped Atlantean savages and the monkeys of those distant times. Therefore, there is a strain of manas, however as yet undeveloped, in the anthropoid and the simian stocks.
Okay, thoughts or questions about this passage? You know, the whole mythology of Hanuman is a great blind for this period where these miscegenations took place. And it's not possible to really unravel it because it's encrusted in tradition and current beliefs about Hanuman. But this is where HPB is here telling us, this is where this originally came from, right? It's now evolved into something quite different. You know, Neem Karoli Baba, who was Ram Dass's guru, was considered to be an incarnation of Hanuman. So it's, he expresses the purely devotional nature. Yeah. Okay. The rest of this passage is mostly review. We've covered it in the past, pointing out the inherent numerical connection between the third round and the third root race of this round, right? There was similar gains made in the third round as was made in the third root race of this round. That's what's called recapitulation, that the first rounds recapitulate gains made in previous, let me say that again. The first root races recapitulate the gains made in previous rounds. Let's take a look at the footnote referenced by the term pithecoid family. Can we get a reader, please?
Yes, Kirsten, can you read that for us, please?
Yes. And if this is found clashing with that other statement which shows the animal later than man, then the reader is asked to bear in mind that the placental mammal only is meant. In those days, there were animals of which zoology does not even dream in our own, and the modes of reproduction were not identical with the notions which modern physiology has upon the subject. It is not altogether convenient to touch upon such questions in public, but there is no contradiction or impossibility in this whatever.
Zoology is the study of animals.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so placental mammals, you know, he says here that the animal, by animal kingdom, he's only talking about placental mammals, right? They range from all the way from mice to humans have placentas, right? Thus, HPB here seems to be inferring that birds, fish, reptiles, amphibians, and insects may have preceded humanity. But, you know, to my knowledge, they're, you know, specific stage by stage theosophical teachings on the advent of the animal kingdom have not been given out. We were told that 11 volumes, she's going through the stanzas, right? That's the nature of this, of the secret doctrine. It's laid out by going through the stanzas. We're in an interim chapter right now, but that's the general way she's moving, developing the secret doctrine, that she left out 11 volumes of stanzas, and that they dealt with this kind of thing, the specifics of the development of the animal kingdom and other such ideas that she didn't include in the secret doctrine, or she would have had time, frankly, to get it written, you know. So they took a look at the time allotted and cut out that type of thing. Okay, next up. This is the final paragraph of this 20-page interim section entitled Additional Facts and Explanations, that we've been on for about a year. So can we get a reader, please?
Magda, can you read that for us, please?
Yes. Thus, the earlier teachings, however unsatisfactory, vague, and fragmentary, did not teach the evolution of man from the ape. Nor does the author of Esoteric Buddhism assert it anywhere in his work in so many words. But owing to his inclination towards modern science, he uses language which might perhaps justify such an inference. The man who preceded the fourth, the Atlantean race, however much he may have looked physically like a gigantic ape, the counterfeit of man who had not the life of man, was still a thinking and already a speaking man. The Lemura Atlantean was a highly civilized race, and if one accepts tradition, which is better history than the speculative fiction which now passes under that name, he was higher than we are with all our sciences and the degraded civilization of the day. At any rate, the Lemura Atlantean of the closing third race was so. And now we may return to the stanzas.
Okay. First, I'm going to just grab a few of these comments. The man who preceded the fourth, the Atlantean race, however much he may have looked physically like a gigantic ape, the counterfeit of man who hath not the life of man, was still a thinking and already a speaking man. So when HPB says the counterfeit of a man who hath not the life of a man, she's describing the animal ape who resembled early third root race humanity. So, you know, there's two types it looked like. One was actually an iteration of humankind that happened to look ape-like. And the other was the actual animal ape. But they have completely different, they come from completely different kingdoms. So let's take a look at the Theosophical Glossary entry on the third root race, because it's being talked about so much here, and you can see the arrow pointing to this little number 3, which is what it describes. I think this will help clear up some confusion. Could we get a reader, please?
Gordon, can you read that for us, please?
Third root race. A period when human evolution passed through a stage analogous to that of the third round, qualified by the fact that it belonged to the fourth round. The date of the beginning of this third root race is set at some 22 or 23 million years ago, and 18 million years ago is given in Theosophical writings as the date of the awakening of mind and the separation of the sexes, at or somewhat after the midpoint of the third root race. The latter date is collated according to the geology of Blavatsky's time, with the later Triassic and earlier Jurassic periods. The filamentoid and boneless structure of the semi-astral human bodies at the end of the second root race, now thickened and condensed, separating itself upon a rapidly developing skeletal form into nervous, muscular, and other systems, combined with the appearance of definite organs with specific functions, thus constituting the first truly physical human beings. The mode of reproduction at the beginning of the root race was by the exudation from the surface of the body of vital sweat or cells, but with the hardening and specialization of the body itself, production of the reproductive cells became localized in special organs, and the mode of generation became oviparous. Later, these human eggs were no longer extruded, as in the case with fowls today, but shrank greatly in size and were developed and fertilized within the body, first in a vaginal manner, and then, before true sex appeared, there ensued a fairly long period of androgynous reproduction in which androgynous humans occasionally gave birth to individuals in whom one or the other sex predominated. And these occasionally appearances, as time passed, became ever more frequent with the recession of androgyny and the final appearance of true sex as it is understood today. The process extended over hundreds of thousands, even a number of millions of years. More important, however, than these biological facts was the awakening of mind, of self-conscious thinking, inaugurated by the descent of the Manasaputras, who not only at first projected sparks of their own full self-consciousness into the innocent and unthinking humanity of these early times, but who likewise so stimulated the appearance of a mind that the latter finally became common in differing degrees to the entire human stock.
Thank you, Gordon. Hopefully this helped you to understand the events of the very important third root race, right? It really brought us from pre-human into the current state of humanity in terms of a procreating, overshadowed race of beings. Okay. So next up, we have the Lemuro-Atlantean, was a highly civilized race. And if one accepts tradition, which is better history than the speculative fiction, which now passes under that name, he was higher than we are with all our sciences and the degraded civilization of the day. At any rate, the Lemuro-Atlantean of the closing third root race was so. So this is a surprising teaching when we think of, you know, the evolution through the races, that, you know, how would it be that the third root race achieved a higher, more developed stage? And the answer is because it ended during a subrace, either the sixth or seventh, that was more advanced than our current fifth subrace. Thus, though they had not developed Manas anywhere near to the extent that we have so far, even in this fifth root race, they would have, in that sixth or seventh subrace, have regained much of their innate spirituality during those final subraces, and that would have placed them in a position where they were quote unquote more highly developed. And now we must return to the stanzas, or may return to the stanzas. With this statement, we complete the interim chapter entitled additional facts and explanations concerning the globes and the monads. So in order to regain some sense of context, I'd like to start by rereading stanza 6, which we were in the middle of when we paused to read about the globes and the monads. And so what I'd like to do is get two readers, one for the first 4 verses, which we covered before the interim chapter, and then we'll have a reader for the last 3 verses, which we will now begin to study. So could we get a reader, please?
Okay, Fred, would you please start us off?
Yes, thank you. By the power of the Mother of Mercy and Knowledge, Kuan Yin, the triple of Kuan Shai Yin residing in Kuan Yin Qian, Poha, the breath of their progeny, the son of the suns, having called forth from the lower abyss the elusive form of Xian Shang and 7 elements. 2, the swift and radiant one produces the 7 Laya centers, against which none will prevail through the great day. Be with us and seat the universe on the eternal foundations surrounding Qian Shan with the elemental germs. 3, of the 7, first 1 manifested, 6 concealed, 2 manifested, 5 concealed, 3 manifested, 4 concealed, 4 produced, 3 hidden, 4 and 1. Just a second. San revealed 2 and 1/2 concealed, 6 to be manifested, 1 laid aside, lastly, 7 small wheels revolve, 1 giving birth to the other. 4, he builds them in the likeness of older wheels, placing them on the imperishable centers. How does he build them? He collects the fiery dust. He makes balls of fire, runs through them and round them, fusing light thereinto, then sets them into motion. Some way, one way, some the other. They are cold. He makes them hot. They are dry. He makes them moist. They shine. He fans and cools them. Thus acts Pohat from one twilight to the other during 7 eternities.
Thank you. And the last 3, please.
Marguerite, can you please read that for us?
5th. At the 4th, the sons are told to create their images. 1/3 refuses to obey. The curse is pronounced. They will be born on the 4th, suffer and cause suffering. This is the first war. 6. The older wheels rotated downwards and upwards. The mother spawn filled the hole. There were battles fought between the creators and the destroyers, and battles fought for space, the seed appearing and reappearing continuously. 7. Make thy calculations, Lanu, if thou wouldst learn the correct age of thy small wheel. Its 4th spoke is our mother. Reach the 4th fruit of the 4th path of knowledge that leads to Nirvana, and thou shalt comprehend, for thou shalt see.
Thank you. Okay. So I just wanted to recreate a framework of just where we are with this. So we'll now reinstate the format for those of you who are with us a year ago and before, which shows the verse at left and the actual page from the Secret Doctrine at right, and then the text that we read in the middle. So we'll continue with the very short verse 5. Could we get a reader, please?
Karen, can you read that for us, please? Karen. Okay, let's go to Anna.
Are you there, Anna?
Huh.
Yes.
Anna Sklar?
Yes.
Hi.
Yeah.
Can you read?
Yes, I can hear.
Okay, thank you.
At the fourth round, this one, number five?
Yeah.
At the fourth round of revolution of life and being around the seven smaller wheels.
Don't worry about those letters.
The sons are told to create the image. One third refused, two third obey. The full meaning of this sloka can be fully comprehended only after reading the detailed additional explanation in the Anthropogenesis and its commentaries in the book two. Between this sloka and the last sloka number four, in the same stanza, extend long ages. And there are now gleams, the dawn and sunrise of another eon. So it's a very big distance between them. The drama enacted on our planet is at the beginning of its fourth act, but for a clear comprehension of the whole play, the reader will have to turn back before he can proceed onwards. For this verse belongs to the general cosmogony given in the archaic volumes, whereas book two will give a detailed account of creation, or rather the formation of the first human being, followed by the secondary humanity, and then by the third or as they are called, the first, second, and the third root races. As the solid earth began by being a ball of liquid fire of fiery dust and its protoplasmic phantom, so did man.
Thank you.
So it means there was between the globes, there was a very big, very big time.
Yes, and we'll get into that. We're going to go through it right now and talk about it. So first up, we have the verse, and then the full meaning of this sloka can be fully comprehended only after reading the detailed additional explanations in Anthropogenesis and its commentaries in book two. So we get some idea of how deep volume two gets into the root races from even a cursory look at its table of contents, which includes chapters on the evolution of the sweatborn, the Hyperboreans, the virgin third race, Lemuria, Atlantis, and the history of the fourth race, just to name a few. I mean, you just take a look at this. It's all about the development of humanity through the root races. Next, between this sloka and the last sloka four, in this same stanza, extend long ages, and there now gleams the dawn and sunrise of another eon. So let's start by taking a look at Manly P. Hall's comments on verse four, which is the verse that we finished last year. And it'll give us some idea of what went before and why there are long ages between the two verses. So just read the column on the right, please. A reader, please.
I'll go ahead. Fohat, the voice of the progeny, built these wheels in the likeness of the great wheel, and according to the plan that had been established eons before. The imperishable center he used as an axis or thread, and upon these centers he strung the wheels or beads. They were capable of being destroyed. The thread was imperishable. Fohat gathered the flaming sparks of space. He made balls of fire, nebula, that ran through them, impregnating them with his energy. He gave them his power, which is motion. They turned in different directions according to the work they had to accomplish. They were cold and dark, the mental air mist. He made them hot, the astral fire mist. He made them moist, humid water ether. He cooled them into solids, chemical dense substances. Thus acts the spirit of Fohat, the lord of change, from the dawn of creation till the twilight, his labors taking 7 eternities. Wow.
Yeah. That's
powerful, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. So you can see how primordial this stuff is, you know. This is primordial creation, the planes of matter, whereas verse 5, which we've just begun, deals with the work of the lunar petries and the advent of humankind in this fourth realm. So in order for the form aspect of humanity to have been successfully created, even in the ethereal matter of the earliest root race of this realm, a stable environment, as outlined in the events of verse 4, had to have been well established. By the way, we at the end of each verse, we pull forth Manly P. Hall's comments on that verse, which are all found in this number 37 of the manuscript series, which you can find online. Okay. So next up.
Hold on a second. Fred, yeah. I see that you have unmuted. Did you want to say something?
No, thank you.
Okay.
It's an accident.
Okay. All right.
And set. So verse 4 shown here, you can see the gap between the two. That's the whole purpose. If you just the tenor of this verse, which is literally the creation of the planes and the beginning of the creation of the human kingdom. Next, the drama enacted on our planet is at the beginning of its fourth act, meaning at the beginning of the fourth round, the drama being the descent into matter of physical humanity, followed by the overshadowing by the Manasaputras, takes place. Okay. Next, this passage suggests that we reread the material immediately before the interim chapter that we just finished, because verse 4 belongs to the, quote, general cosmogony given in the archaic volumes, as do all the earlier verses of this and the first 5 stanzas. So just go back and watch all 72 episodes of the Secret Doctrine, and you'll be able to recapitulate all of this. But they are available, as I mentioned in the beginning, if you know you have any interest in that. This passage points to the material in volume 2, which we got a taste of in the interim chapter that we just finished. There's a lot of that same type of material. We're describing the nature of creation and how it unfolds. And finally, as the solid earth began by being a ball of liquid fire, of fiery dust and its protoplasmic phantom, so did man. Since both began as liquid fire, remember that first plane on which the rounds, the globes and the rounds commence, is one of fire. Humanity is inextricably linked with the elemental evolution of the globe itself on which it finds itself. But the development of humanity is not incidental to the development of the globe, but rather constitutes the main purpose for that development. In other words, it's really the globe supporting the development of humankind. And it's the purpose of the globe. Next up, can we get a reader, please?
Yes. Yvonne, can you read that, please?
Sure. A, that which is meant by the qualification, the fourth, is explained as the fourth round only on the authority of the commentaries. It can equally mean fourth eternity as fourth round, or even fourth our globe. For as will repeatedly be shown, it is the fourth sphere on the fourth or lowest plane of material life. And it so happens that we are in the fourth round, at the middle point of which the perfect equilibrium between spirit and matter had to take place, says the commentary explaining the verse. The whole use, the gods, refuse to multiply and create species after their likeness, after their kind. They are not fit forms, rupas, for us. They have to grow. They refuse to enter the chahayas, shadows, or images of their inferiors. Thus had selfish feeling prevailed from the beginning, even among the gods, and they fell under the eye of karmic lapikas. They had to suffer for it in later births. How the punishment reached the gods will be seen in the second volume.
Okay, thank you, Yvonne. So first, that which is meant by the qualification of the fourth is explained as the fourth round, only on the authority of the commentaries. Remember, she has the original text of the actual slokas and verses, which is among the most ancient writings in the possession of the hierarchy. And then she has made available to her, through her own etheric vision, commentaries, not published commentaries like she's giving us here, but commentaries that she quotes from on these verses. So she's saying they didn't, that the qualification of the fourth as being around was not in the original verse, but was only in the commentaries. It just means that the original verse didn't include the word round and is thus making a distinction between the authority of the ancient original verses and the commentary that she had access to while writing the secret doctrine. Without the commentary, the original verse reads, at the fourth, the sons are told to create their images. One third refuses to obey. Next. It can equally mean fourth eternity as fourth round, or even the fourth our globe, for as will repeatedly be shown, it is the fourth sphere on the fourth or lowest plane of material life. So fourth eternity probably refers to the fourth chain. This statement underscores the fact that fulfillment of the will to be, the imperative to manifest, sent forth by the Logos, always characterizes the fourth in a series at whatever level that number four is manifesting, right? The fourth or lowest plane of material life refers to the descent through the elements from fire, air, water, and earth. Remember, these are primordial elements and are thus only figurative related to the elements as we know them. But it's really at the earth that the will to be is finally completely fulfilled, the logoic will to be. Next, And it so happens that we are in the fourth round, at the middle point of which the perfect equilibrium between spirit and matter had to take place. There are two fundamental ideas slash meanings represented by the number four. One of these is symbolized by the square, which represents the form world. For example, an old commentary from Discipleship in the New Age, Volume 1 states, I, the triangle divine, work out that will within the square and serve my fellow men. The passage we are currently studying from the SD on the perfect equilibrium between spirit and matter is alluding to the other commonly used meaning of the number four, which is the midway point between the first and the seventh, which marks the culmination of the involutionary and the commencement of the evolutionary cycle, thus marking a point of equilibrium between spirit and matter. So let's take a look at this excerpt from A Treatise on Cosmic Fire, which describes the influence of the midway point. We'll use two readers for this.
Martha, can you please start us off?
Yes. The scheme is considered as the fourth and the one of the most important in the system during this particular cycle for the following reasons. Our solar system, being considered as of the fourth order, and our scheme being the fourth in order, there is consequently a moment of special opportunity.
Oops, Martha, we lost you.
Oh,
there, that's better.
Okay, sorry. I'll start the sentence over. There's a moment of special opportunity afforded our planetary logos through the alignment brought about. It eventuates in the turning of the attention of the logoic kundalini fire towards this center. Our scheme and the subsequent results are in the process of working out. Within the scheme, the chain that concerns us the most and which is temporarily of the most vital importance to the planetary logos is the Earth chain, the fourth in order again, thus bringing about another alignment of very grave moment. Did I overreach? Or did I keep going? This carries with it special opportunity and permits of the entry of force from the cosmos itself or of extra systemic electric vitality. This super stimulation results in what looks to us like cataclysms and a stupendous shattering of forms, but it is simply the necessary sequence to the vitalization of the life within the form and the breaking of the limiting form unable to bear the cosmic action. Again, within the chain, the globe at present receiving planetary polarization, or at present embodying in a special sense the life of the planetary logos, is the Earth, the fourth in order. This brings about a still further alignment.
Thank you, Martha. Sure. Okay, another reader.
Magda, can you read that second part, please?
Sure. Add to the above facts the accepted knowledge that it is the fourth round and we have a fivefold alignment, which is of paramount significance to us all, though it had even greater significance and force in the fourth root race and brought about that stupendous psychic event, the opening of the door of initiation to the human hierarchy. These very important facts merit close attention, and the consideration of all occult students. They hold the key whereby some comprehension of manas and of planetary evolution may come about. What have we, therefore, in this special cyclic alignment? First, a solar system of the fourth order. Second, the fourth scheme in the system. Third, the fourth chain in the scheme. Fourth, the fourth globe in the chain. And fifth, the fourth round. All these are found active within the same cycle, and all the four bring about a simultaneous alignment, which results in the clearing of a channel direct from the heart of our scheme through every ring pass knot to the cosmic correspondence found outside the solar sphere. To the above realization, we must add yet the farther fact that the fourth creative hierarchy is the one whose evolution we are considering, and it will be apparent to the most superficial student that in these thoughts lies hidden the clue, not only to man, but to the entire cyclic evolution in which he's taking part.
Okay, answer questions about this. Thank you, Magda. I see you some questions.
Yeah, Gordon, please go ahead.
What is meant by the solar system of fourth order?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's because it's about to take the fourth initiation on cosmic initiation. That's what it's preparing for. And this is part of the alignment with the energy of fourness. I see another hand.
Yes, Ariane, go ahead.
Thank you. So when they talk about the sons are told to create in the image of something and one third refused, could you explain that more deeply? Like, first of all, who refused and what exactly did they refuse? And how does that relate to the people on this planet today?
Okay, I'll give you a thumbnail, but then the next webinar on secret doctrine, we're going to be getting into this extensively, because that's where the subject matter goes from this point in the secret doctrine. So we'll be going there. It's a very obtuse teaching, which is that there were these beings that were so highly placed that they have their own fully developed will, and they refused to do the bidding of the planetary logos that was attempting to impel them into overshadow human beings, as the Manasaputras did. Now, two-thirds did do that. They chose to, you could say, locate on the higher monastic plane and overshadow humanity, but one-third refused to do this and therefore made themselves available for the development of the higher principles of a human being. But this really is the subject matter of our next webinar. So hope you'll be here for that. Okay, a hand up.
Magda, please go ahead.
Yes, my question is about this subject. And I'm asking if in the next webinar, we will be dealing specifically with this decayed angels. So to say, I guess this is what we're talking about. They didn't complete the sacrifice and didn't make available their form to humans. So are we, will be in the next webinar contextualizing?
I'll be talking about that. It's actually two groups.
The two groups.
Yeah, it's two groups. It's, as far as I can understand, it's always couched in such, archaic language. It's sometimes difficult to determine. But as far as I can understand it, what we're looking at is those who held back before they overshadowed humanity. That was the Manasaputras that eventually acquiesced to overshadow humanity. And during the interim between when humanity was able to procreate and when they did agree to overshadow him, we had these half man, half animal creatures created who are now will enter into a process which will eventually result in them entering the human family entirely. That's one group. And then you have this other group of very highly evolved Dhyani Chohans, also called Asuras, Sura being form, Asura meaning no form at all. And they're actually this higher than the cosmic physical plane. And they I described them before when I said that they actually had the agency to refuse the command of the planetary logos to descend into matter. But that made them available because they were able to hold on to their high estate, you could say. That made them available to develop the higher human principles, like, for instance, Atma Buddhi Manas and the monadic sheath. So, but like I said, we're going to be exploring that in depth next time.
Okay, thank you.
You bet. Anyone else? Okay. You know, for those who weren't with us last time, I'm now ending webinars at an hour and a half instead of an hour and 45 minutes. So that's it for this time, and hope to see you on the third Sunday of December, unless it falls, I haven't checked. It doesn't fall on Christmas or something, does it?
No, it doesn't. The next Secret Doctrine is going to be on the 17th of December.
Oh, good.
The next Treatise on Cosmic Fire is going to be the 24th of November. So that's going to be the next one up.
That's and this then, Friday.
Right. And then the next Secret Teaching of All Ages is going to be on the 3rd of December. And all of those, well, the Secret Doctrine and the Secret Teaching of All Ages will be at 8 p.m. I'm not sure about PCF.
They're all at 8 p.m. They're all at this time. I'm not able to shift one back an hour like we initially talked about. They're all at 8 p.m. GMT, the time that the webinar started today. That's going to be the time of any and all of the webinars.
Thank you.
Okay, Martha, did you have something you wanted to say?
Doesn't sound like it. Okay, you all. Be well. See you. Hopefully see you this Friday for a Treatise on Cosmic Fire.
Thank you. Okay, everybody. Goodbye.
Thank you, BL. Thank you, Francis.
Bye-bye.
If I don't see any of you before then, happy Thanksgiving.
You too.
Yeah, you too.
Bye.
You too. Have a good one.